You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Clandestine intro recording at my work, so I'm being quiet and subtle. First, welcome to our new theme month. I hope you enjoyed the last episode, and I hope you enjoyed this one. Second, it's interesting. Some of you may know that I teach, but I had some students who were randomly talking about this movie in class, having never seen it, and still talking about how great that twist was. So I guess, you know, whatever, a decade and a half, 2 decades later, it still works. So whatever. So, finally, make sure you're on the Facebook group. Thanks for supporting me, those who came out to War Games last week. Cineprov will be performing on next Thursday, or the first Thursday of the month, which I believe is the 3rd. And then on that Friday, I will be performing at Monsterama. So, plenty of chances to see some riffing, and I hope to see you there. And then finally, thanks for supporting us. You know, so far into this new time, I guess, we've been doing really well. So I appreciate that. And I hope you keep joining us every week as we put some more of your past on trial. Thanks, guys.
Curious about the real or fictional worlds?
In the beginning, there were laser kings and giant robots.
Those who created.
I'm going to feed you to this tentacle monster now. No.
Or what inspires.
And I remember being in my room with my brother, and we immediately, like within 5 seconds, he decided he was a DC fan, and I decided I was a Marvel fan, and we were going through and sorting out all the comics.
And then join Hubie Tigers, the only podcast show who will take life by the tail. Now available on Google Play, Stitcher, and iTunes, and of course, your favorite podcasting app. This is Hubie Tigers.
Welcome to Better Godhood. This week we watched 1999's Fight Club. Oh, I had a joke. Did I have a joke? I didn't have a joke. Whatever.
We'll find it sooner or later. Don't worry.
Yeah, no kidding. The reason why an IKEA has opened in Atlanta. I'm host Nick Hoffman, host of My Open Finish Childhood and Riffron Cineprov, and we have a panel today.
Matthew W. Quinn, the one and only.
Hello, this is Daniel, and I was awake at 4 a.m. pissing in soup.
There you go.
And I'm Candace, and that was my soup, and I'm really upset.
And so did you have a class action lawsuit against Daniel?
Probably.
No.
You will not stop Project Mayhem.
So this is my choice for Daniel's college month. We thought it was cool in college. I remember why this movie went away when I rewatched the end scene, and then came roaring back in the mid-2000s once we were okay with buildings exploding again. Mm. This is kind of a perfect example of movies we thought were cool in college. Now, without giving anything away here, I remember everyone around 2001, 2002, 2003, when this came out, in 99, right?
Yeah, 99.
So I saw it in probably 99, 2000, and then I saw it again in college. Mm-hmm. And just the idea of the anti-capitalist, everything is bullshit, like, this is kind of the ultimate pissy teenager. Like,
well, that's the thing about the movie with a lot of people. When they're younger, they're on Tyler Durden's side, and as you get older, you realize what they meant all along, which is that Tyler Durden is evil.
Yeah. I kind of loved this movie at the time because A, it's David Fincher. I then read the book. I read a bunch of his books. They're all insane.
Oh, did you ever read, what was that collection of short stories he did that was like framed as a novel?
I read that. Is that the one that has a story about the guy who gets his intestines sucked
yes,
out?
Yes, that one.
I read it. I can't remember much about it.
What the f*** were y'all reading?
That was one of the...
I tell you what, Chuck Palahniuk... Palahniuk, Steve from Ohio, is just a weird writer, man. Like they tried to make another one of his books, Choke.
Oh, Choked. That actually wasn't a bad movie.
It's
weird.
You saw this movie?
Yeah.
The narrative structure, where it feels like halfway through the movie, a different director picks it up, and it goes from being like the first act is a masterpiece, and then it goes into Project Mayhem. That's how all of his books feel.
So you mean like every Star Wars movie that's been made by Disney?
Yeah, where all of a sudden it just shifts tone for no reason.
Yep.
Three directors later.
Three directors later, exactly. I will say too, I saw this movie because in early high school, late middle school, I saw Seven, which was the movie that came before this with Brad Pitt.
Seven
was
good.
That's a masterpiece. And I was like, Brad Pitt, David Fincher, ooh, I'm getting tingles. Maybe someone's head will end up in a box again. I guess, spoilers. And somehow less rapey than Kevin Spacey, we have Ed Norton.
Do we have a rapey scale so that way then we can like they can move up and down? We can like put their heads on a little thing up and down.
A little bobbly head Kevin Spacey, like, no, you shouldn't have looked in the secret box.
Now who would be zero on that scale at this point?
Mr. Rogers.
Mr. Rogers.
He's the only good person.
High five. I love you.
I love you too.
Okay, now who would be the five on that scale?
Well, Roman Polanski just doesn't work because no one knows what he looks like.
No.
The thing is, he looks like Quentin Tarantino. Even though he's not a rapist, Quentin Tarantino looks like a rapist. I mean, not to judge a book by his cover, but he's sweating in places that people don't sweat.
Do you know how many times I've been compared to looking like Quentin Tarantino throughout my life?
How sober were the people doing it? You have a figure. He's a skeleton with a walking rape mask.
Not anymore. He's not. He reaches middle age, he's put on a couple
pounds.
His head is shaped like Mac Tonight.
So at level five, is that a rapist that like... You're like, well, you know, he's kind of hot. I guess halfway through, you're like, maybe it's not so bad. Like, I would feel like that way about Quentin Tarantino.
Robin Thicke. That's Robin Thicke right there.
I mean, I guess I was going to say like a football guy, but no, Robin Thicke. Oh, that's funny.
Remember him? He was popular about 6 years ago.
Sure was.
I got to tell you, I'm on my third Moscow Mule, and you totally look like Quentin Tarantino.
Do I look like anyone significant?
I'm going to think about it.
We'll get back to you.
On number eight, I'll let you know.
Okay. All right.
So this was kind of the who from history would you fight speech that we had for today.
Speaking of, Daniel, give us our plot synopsis.
It's about an unnamed narrator who suffers from insomnia, and as it turns out, a whole bunch of mental ailments, where he goes to support groups in order to feel better
things
about himself. Yeah, feel anything, really. And eventually, he finds it's not working for him anymore because this woman named Marla Singer is doing the same thing he's doing, and so he feels bad. About after the third act, and this is kind of a weird... The first act, and this is kind of a weird transition, he's on a plane and meets a guy named Tyler Durden, who makes and sells soap. Soon afterwards, his condo gets blown up. He calls Tyler and asks to move in with him. And slowly, they start a bunch of underground boxing clubs that they call Fight Club. And there are rules, and you've got to pay dues. Not really, but...
I'm going to stop you there. We know the rules to Fight Club.
In fact, he's going to stop you because the first rule of Fight Club is you don't talk about Fight Club. So that's it. That's the end of the show, folks. Have a great time. Thank you.
Which LA Times film reviewer, do you know his name?
Elvis... No, not Elvis Mitchell, is it?
No, the other one. But he goes... He hated the movie, but he goes, first rule of Fight Club is you don't talk about Fight Club. The second rule is why should anyone want to? And I thought that was the best review I'd ever heard.
Ebert hated this movie, too.
Ebert very much hated this movie.
The vibe I got of him is he probably thought it was serious that, you know, Tyler Durden is right.
Well,
that's what he called
no.
fascist.
Well, I mean, it is fascist. But
Rosie O'Donnell also hated the film.
She spoiled it on like the Today Show.
That is correct.
Why, hello, I'm here to talk about this movie.
And girls playing baseball.
Do you remember when I was Barney Rubble's wife?
Simpler times, my friend.
Was it Rick Moranis playing Bunny Rabbit? Jesus Christ, that's a stay tuned.
In fact, that was the only movie he ever played in following his wife's passing.
That's correct. He hasn't been in something since.
I thought he was in Honey, We Shrunk Ourselves thing that came out.
His wife was still living at that time.
This came after that, didn't it?
No, I thought the third Honey, I Shrunk the Kids movie was like way after that.
Son of a bitch, I'm going to work Google.
That bastard, he spoiled his wife's memory. Mm. You're right, we should end the podcast. That was one written by Joel, right?
Yes, it was.
Oh, God damn it.
Joel, the singer?
Joel Hodgson from Mystery Science Theater. So, we're on a first name basis.
We're really close and shit.
So anyway,
we steal his intellectual property.
So anyway, after that, a Fight Club slowly gets out of control and it evolves into a full-blown cult.
Oh, I remember my joke. Fight Club, the reason why your racist uncle calls you a snowflake.
Oh, yeah. Well,
that's where this comes from.
Yeah.
I thought that came from Fox News.
No, it's that's when they say, like, snowflakes don't deserve independence. You're not special. You're not a snowflake. Like, that's that rant in the middle. That's where that comes from.
That's why I love pointing out to all the...
Okay, Candace needs a minute.
That's why I love pointing out to all the bro Nazis where that term comes from. It comes from an openly gay author, so congratulations, bro
and an
Nazis.
anarchist cookbook. Like, literally, like... You need a refresher, don't you?
Yeah. Mama needs her nip.
All right, finish your plot summary. I'll stop interrupting.
Well, it turns out that this narrator and Tyler Durden are the same person because the narrator's suffering from some sort of severe form of schizophrenia or multiple personality disorder or both or neither. Anyway, he goes out and tries to stop this new cult from blowing up a bunch of buildings in downtown. I think it's Boston.
I think so as well. And I do think it's multiple personality as opposed to schizophrenia, because schizophrenia generally it declares itself in late teens and early 20s in adult males.
Donnie Darko is schizophrenia. This is dissociative identity.
Mm-hmm.
That's well, at the same time, though, do you necessarily see like your alternate, the voice? Well, he's both taking on this alternate personality and he's seeing and hearing this other figure that he just invented.
It's definitely not from under the schizophrenic base, but I don't know the other. If you were to look in like the MD classification book that like lets you know what the people have, which one it is.
This has been what do you have on all
what to expect
considered.
You're expectorating into soup.
It's called You Can't Afford Healthcare, so listen to this myopia podcast and it might fucking help you.
Okay, so I had the first question I have. Well, we'll get to the first scene, which is excellent, but just because you're done with describing stuff.
That was a great drink, by the way.
You're welcome. Is Tyler Durden ever real? And the reason I ask that is you see Brad Pitt, who plays Tyler Durden, going through the airport before they've met. Mm-hmm. So I wonder if he doesn't see a cool dude go by and just decide that he's real. Just because, like, even next to him in the seat, mm-hmm. there's no reason for us to not think he's real.
Oh, there's a whole bunch of times you see him in the movie. There's like a couple frame flashes when he's at the doctor's office in that one bit where he's...
he's looking in the window.
And when he's checking into the hotel at that whole introductory video from the staff, Tyler Durden's a member of that staff, so he's going, welcome!
Yeah, right, but my question is are we supposed to think he's at any point real? Because, like, technically, when he's sitting next to him and saying it's soap, could just be a guy selling soap, because the idea that a guy selling soap could go across the country is absurd if he's just pissing into pots.
I don't think he was ever real. Quite
I think
honestly.
It's good. Well, that's what I'm saying. It's good filmmaking. It hides the fact that he's fake until much later. I think.
Well, and I actually have something to say on that, and that is when you're. Okay, this is a two-part story. So the first part is when I was in 11th grade is when this came out.
Yep.
Because I'm a little bit older than Nick. And my friend Miranda, who was a very bad influence, decided to bring me over to her house, and she was like, let's get drunk and watch this movie. She was obsessed with Seven, so it made sense. And we watched it, and I was so f***ed up that I didn't realize until I rewatched the movie in my mid-20s that they were the same person. So that's the opening statement.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, exactly. So that was awful. But then the second part of that is that I was telling Nick earlier that had the character of Marla not been in the film, I think I would have figured it out earlier that they were the same person.
Yeah.
It was by Marla's reaction to the two of them and how it was so vastly different is why I really believe there was two separate identities and two different people.
I agree. And I think that's something that they do really well in this movie, where you have this kind of, like, the world reacts to Tyler and reacts to Ed Norton, who I think we end up calling Jack. He starts referring to himself as Jack, even though we don't really know his name.
Well, he's referred to as Rupert in that one scene, I think.
Well, in Cornelius.
Right.
But he finds that book of short stories written from the point of view of the organs of the people who lived in the house before. And from then on out, he goes, I'm Jack's anxious medulla oblongata. Yeah, okay.
I am Jack's flatulent colon. I don't know.
Splastic colon.
Oh, there you go.
Splastic is a word I just said. It's science.
It's closer to the word that I meant, but
it's okay. I'm almost a doctor.
Yeah. Is that why you keep asking me to bend over at weird times?
Yeah, well, it's for science.
I love science.
I love science, too. It's one of the things we have in common, is River.
One of the things about it that works for the first couple of times, because when you're in college, part of the thing that makes it sound smart is when you go back, it's like, oh, cool, that was something I didn't notice that hits at that big twist. Like, for example, when he calls Tyler after his condo blows up, he, the narrator, Rupert, Cornelius, Jack, whatever, and then Tyler doesn't pick up and then immediately calls back the payphone referencing Star 69, which was a thing that used to exist, kids. If you, like, pause at a certain point, you can see that the payphone says, this phone does not accept incoming calls, stuff yeah. like that.
Well, and I mean,
which is just a gimmick more than anything else. Now,
it's a stupid plot device is what it is. But I will say, that's the point where I thought it was like a Jacob's Ladder scenario, right? Where, like, he calls, no one answers. And so, like, that's the point where I thought this is where it becomes his fantasy. Right? Because beforehand, he really could have just been sitting next to a guy in the airplane that he thought was so cool. Because I've met those people. No one's at the table here. But, you know, someone who I thought was so cool. No. I don't pretend I'm a chick, usually. The heels just don't fit a size 13 shoe.
That's not true. Come to the Rocky Horror Picture Show and find out all about it.
Friday nights.
Ponce de Leon.
Are we doing
Plaza Theater, 1049 Ponce de Leon Avenue. Thank you.
Are we doing that for Cool in College Month? Because I got to say, that might fit.
Oh, shit. I will tear the f*** out of that movie.
Patreon. If you pay us, we'll do it. I just
do it. All right, listen up, folks. I get no money out of this, just like Rocky Horror. So please give the f***ing Patreon your money so I can come on here and rant about the 18 years of my youth I have f***ing lost due to this film.
No, this seems like one of those NPR, like, sound booth, like, just, now tell me what Rocky Horror did to you. And you're just like, and you tell your story about the last 18 years, but you have to do it like a Southern Belle. Now, I first was introduced to the Rocky Horror Picture Show.
I was 15 years old and performing at the Chamber, which was a bondage club. And now I look back and think, that was bad.
I'm just picturing, when you said Southern Belle, I'm just picturing Zelda P. Rubinstein doing that.
Child, when I first saw the Rocky Horror Picture Show, I saw Frankenfurter come out in those fishnets, and child, I was a changed woman.
Colonel Frankenfurter, I do declare.
Whatever happened to Saturday night? Oh.
All right. Okay.
That's
the mic drop right there.
That's it.
That was the mic.
No, I mean that, and I will totally do it just as a Patreon episode. You and I just talk it through, like as though it's, I'm Dr. Phil. Now I'm sorry. You told me you had a problem with the Rocky Horror Picture. All right. So the first scene, I think we should, the first like two scenes, three scenes, we should kind of just talk about because it really sets up the movie well. We have Ed Norton's character who never really gets a name. He starts referring to himself as Jack, kind of. So, Jack.
There's a comic book sequel out there, which don't read it because it's terrible, but he's referred to as Sebastian throughout.
Regardless, he's talking about the kind of mindlessness of middle class whiteness. This is the whitest movie that ever whited to white manliness, especially the idea of lost masculinity via capitalism.
Well, it's also more obvious than I remember it being, because it's like, first off, when you're younger, it's like, yeah, that's totally awesome, and it's like all anti-capitalist and stuff, and it really is demasculating us. But the opening scene is at a testicular cancer support where he's crying into somebody who's literally lost his balls.
Yeah. And I mean, My favorite scene, which is a very un-David Fincher scene for David Fincher, but it's a great scene, is when he's sitting on the toilet with the IKEA catalog and he's ordering stuff, and then it goes through his apartment and points out the little things.
Yep. And he talks about the bubbles in the vase that shows that it's handcrafted by an ethically sourced...
the indigenous people of wherever it is.
Yes, and I was like, and it's so funny because I, you know, I'm just going to say as an overall real quick so you'll know where I'm coming from. I thought this was, not only did this movie hold up, it was even better when I watched it today, because I actually watched it today, and it was awesome.
Straight.
And it was great. It was everything I remembered, but even better, because all the little nuances and loss of hope that happen when you work in healthcare, well, anywhere,
yeah.
So I guess, yeah. Oh my God, I was like, I'm picking up on all these great little nuggets that I never got as the 11th grader that was drunk at my friend's house playing hooky, or as even the 24-year-old who was like, the establishment, you know.
Well, and it's also, it's funny because it's the other way around too. Like, the people who are playing at that middle class dream aren't people who grew up middle class. They're the people who want to look middle class. And so when you first get your place out of college, you're like, man, if only I had a coffee table for some reason, because a coffee table and some end tables will make me feel like an adult.
Yeah.
And I went to the IKEA. It's down the street next to the really good donut place. That's an independent donut place.
Ooh.
And you're just like, and there's this little disconnects of like, why do I need an empty apartment with like a side table that I use only to put my one glass on when I'm watching my TV? Like, it's all bullshit.
I had an IKEA.
And yet, I do own it.
I had an IKEA futon back in the day. I thought it was the coolest thing.
I'll let you tour my house. Guess what's IKEA and what isn't?
Well, I know those shelves.
I have a lot of IKEA stuff. It works for me.
It's the point.
I'm a fatty, and I go to IKEA just for the fucking cinnamon rolls.
Right?
Right.
Not the meatballs.
The dollar hot dog. No, it's the hot dogs and the cinnamon rolls. That's the bargain basement,
man. Your fucking cinnamon roll game is on point. I'm a big girl, and I know about a cinnamon roll game. Just saying.
Shoot, I was just about to say that. You telepathically sold my joke.
Well, the weird thing about
to the one lady on the panel, girl, is fine. It's totally appropriate.
The entire first act's kind of weird because it is so disconnected from the rest of the movie. I mean, you don't meet Tyler really until 20, 30 minutes into the movie.
Yeah, that's a good point. Something I never really thought of. The first third or so of the movie is all about him going to support groups and divvying them up into spheres of influence with Marla.
Mm-hmm.
Then he meets Tyler and people start beating each other up in the basement.
Well, and it's actually, I think, well constructed as far as the movie goes, just because it really is a speed bump. Because like, there's fast editing. He cuts. He's crying on bitch tits, which is Meatloaf. Bob's with bitch tits. And then there's a speed bump where he's sitting next to someone on the plane, and he goes, "You're the most interesting single-serving friend I've ever met." And he goes, "Clever. How's that working out for you?" Which is a compliment I've gotten at Cineprop. I told you this. Where someone goes, "Your impression was really... Were you the one doing the Stallone impression?" I'm like, "Yeah." He goes, "Okay." And walks away. It's not a compliment. He goes, "No. So how's that working out, being clever?" I'm like, it's not paying any bills. You're fine.
But that's okay. That Patreon for Rocky Horror is going to totally pay off. You're fine.
Make it rain.
Okay, now we're going to get into some deep film theory here because I have a question. Please. Is Marla Singer a manic pixie dream girl?
No, because she's none of those things.
No, she's a Crew Shadows fan who wishes she was Helen Bonham Carter.
I disagree, simply because I think she is trying to embody that 60s free spirit. She's just not happy, but I mean, at the same time, you know, she's completely skewed.
That's totally wrong. I was, like, in 11th grade, I was fucking Marla.
Yeah.
Like, I was sad. I wore all black. I did Rocky. Oh, shit, I'm still that way. Anyways, but that's exactly what my goal was, to be as emo and fucked up and tell everyone I give no shits on whether I lived or died. And that was my theme.
Yeah, well, aren't manic pixie dream girl supposed to be happy?
Yeah.
She's manic pixie Courtney Love.
Oh, that's good.
Oh, so good point.
Manic depressive pixie dream girl,
maybe. Let me tell
you
a fun fact. So, for Marla, the original part was actually they wanted Winona Ryder.
That would have been something.
Which I think would have been amazing. She couldn't get her. And Courtney Love actually went to the director and tried to get the part.
Oh, well.
And he turned her down.
If you've ever seen The People versus Larry Flint or Man on the Moon, she can act. She can.
Well, that's why they picked Ed Norton, was because of the Larry People versus Larry Flint.
Oh, yeah,
because
he was Larry Flint's
attorney.
That
is why this director originally picked Ed Norton for this film. And so it was unusual. So that's how she knew about it. And she went and asked, and he was like, "No, you're..." I think he kind of was like, "You're too unstable."
I think you're right. Well, I mean, okay, so just for a sec, we should talk about Ed Norton.
Yeah.
He's great. I think he just went too far down the path of look like a nice guy and I can be an asshole, because American History X is fine, but this is that American History X. It's Fight Club, and there's another movie he did where he plays a racist.
Death to Smoochie?
No, Death to Mrs. Smoochie is a masterpiece. How dare you, sir? It's a sequel to Mrs. Doubtfire in every way.
The point is, he's not a racist. He just gets entrapped by some of them.
Well, he just does a bunch of movies like this back to back to back, and people just assume he's kind of that, and he stops. And he's also apparently an asshole.
That's what I've heard, is that he's impossible to work with, and he's like such a diva.
Well, that's
so
funny.
I tell you, let's say fantasy cast, a little fantasy football going on here.
Okay.
If not Ed Norton in that part, who do you think would have done a better job?
The guy from Moon.
Sam Rockwell?
Sam Rockwell would have been great.
Okay. What about you, Matt?
I really don't know.
Okay.
Right. I do like the gangliness, though. Like, Ed Norton doesn't look like a tough guy, and then when Brad Pitt takes off his shirt, he's ripped, you know? Patrick Stewart.
Right. Okay. What do you say, Daniel?
Considering how 90s this movie is, I mean, we're already referencing people ordering from catalogs while they're on the toilet, which nobody's going to understand now. Back in the day, Amazon only sold books. Anyway, my pick to embody that 90-ness nerd, David Schwimmer.
That's Ross,
okay.
Right?
Yes, yeah. That's Ross from Friends, yeah.
Oh, my God. And if the bad version of him is John Travolta with his head shaved and going, what are you doing? Like, because when he gets his fat guy rage going, girl.
Okay, so I have to say that was a really good suggestion, because I was thinking of nowadays actors.
Yeah.
And I actually would have gone with Jim Carrey. Because he's so f***ing scary and freaky and weird and kind of method.
As Tyler Durden or as Ed Norton?
Oh, no, as Ed Norton, obviously.
Oh, God.
But back then, he was still too whimsical and fun. You know, he was still like Fire Marshal Bill back then. So I actually like your Ross suggestion.
Actually, you know what would be interesting? If it were someone who was more of an ideal, like, sex type. So, like, what if it were, like, Will Ferrell as Ed Norton, just kind of gangly and, right? No, but someone who, because before this, Ed Norton was not a horror guy. He was more of a lighthearted guy.
Well, he did Primal Fear before this.
I have an idea.
Yeah. And
Adam Sandler, when he's doing his serious
mode. But he's this tall. Well, but then I was thinking of one of the Hemsworths as Tyler Durden. Right?
Yeah.
Opposite Will Ferrell, they're the same height, they're both, and then one is fat and kind of pudgy middle age, and one is fucking Thor. Right? Or one is Thor's brother. Right? The dichotomy is not that Ed Norton is anything other than Ed Norton. If you put him in glasses, it looks like your accountant. Right? He doesn't look like anything. He's not an unattractive guy. He's just a nothing guy.
He's fucking Ben from Parks and Rec.
Chris Pratt is what you're thinking.
Well, no. I mean, Chris Pratt's fun and lovable and sweet, but Ben is that dorky accountant.
No.
You know, but, let's create f***ing Cones of Dunshire kind of bullshit.
No, but I mean, like, we could literally cast the whole thing out of the Parks and Rec crew.
Okay, that's it. That's what we're doing next. That's also on the Patreon, folks.
So
I'm going to make you so
Aubrey
much
Plaza is Helena Bonham Carter, and there's no change to anything about it. Oh my God, and that hardscrabble police officer who's from Arson is Nick Offerman, who's just like, now we're concerned about dynamite that was homemade. Only if Amy Poehler is the narrator, and all of a sudden it feels like you could hear a train trolley just going by the whole time.
Oh my God. I want it to be really upbeat, though. I want, like, a Chris Traeger kind of narration.
Yes! Oh, my God. This is so good.
This is so fun.
I don't know. I mean, the thing about this movie for me, looking back at it, is it's a kind of bleakness that most of the time I just don't feel anymore. When I was in my early 20s, like, I had broken up with my high school girlfriend. I was angry at a bunch of stuff. And, you know, the world felt like it was burning. With, like, the war in Iraq and Afghanistan, I was just like, yeah, this is just doesn't feel like anything's working. Why not burn it down? And now I'm just like, man, everyone in this movie is wrong. From beginning to end, everyone is wrong. Well, the doctor who doesn't give him Ambien even feels like, why are you denying this man medical care when he's clearly very sick?
Because he obviously doesn't have insurance.
Yes, you're 100% right, but he works for Ford. At least in the book, he works for Ford. He has insurance.
Well, the whole thing about what this movie is now, as I'm watching, it's like, this is how cults work. They find very vulnerable people at very low points in their lives where they do feel hopeless, and they give them meaning.
Yeah, that's why. That's what I was gonna say. That's what I was gonna say is this movie shows a seductiveness of extremism because a lot of stuff he's saying isn't wrong. Materialism and consumerism are bad things, and getting them into the fight clubs that teaches them to excel physically, and they get exercise, and they all agree to do it. So no one's getting hurt, and then all of a sudden they're blowing things up.
Yeah,
so. Evil can be very reasonable and suave sounding sometimes. You just got to keep your brain on.
Well, first, I disagree with the sentiment that people aren't getting hurt. That's kind of the whole point. They are getting hurt, but no,
yes,
voluntarily.
But they're allowing themselves to be hurt. And I agree with Matt here because, like, the thing is, they're not like this. Isn't like politicians doing it. These are the people who get shat on. Like, this is, to quote Dilbert, this is like the guild. These are like. The people who clean up after you, these are the janitors and the electricians, the people who are in your house that you don't even make eye contact with.
We serve your food. We guard you in your sleep. Do not mess with us.
Mm-hmm.
You can swear on the internet, Matt. It's okay.
No, I mean, I've read his blog. You don't want
him
to swear.
Matt is a good person. And if he didn't do that, then what's my f***ing point to be here?
Right.
Stop tormenting me, Nick.
The Last Temptation of Nick. Anyway, so to that end, I think Matt is 100%. Like, it's interesting for me to look at this now because, to be as cliche as possible, the last Chuck Palahniuk book I read, I was sitting by the pool at the apartment I was at drinking a beer without a shirt on. I was like, oh, yes, I'm tanning. And he's making some really good points. I'm just like, oh, no.
This isn't the one about the pool, is it?
No, this is the one where the kid keeps trying to get rabies.
Okay.
It's bullshit.
So I think this movie holds up well because there will always be that young version of you, Nick, that will be the person that still feels disenfranchised and upset and angry with the world and recently broke up with a girlfriend and doesn't have a beautiful house and cute animals and adorable child and a pretty wife. You know, like me, I don't have any of those things and I still feel pretty pissed.
I mean, pretty wife you can handle, I think.
I hate to interrupt, but I do have to ask two questions first and foremost. Yeah. Well, question and a point.
Okay.
First, my question, are you saying that Nick was ever somewhere, looked around, was like, wait, this is not my beautiful house. This is not my beautiful wife. He's giving
right here, buddy.
He's giving me the finger, ladies and gentlemen. Now I deserve
I'm
that.
Pointing out the love I have for him with my finger.
Well, the fact that Nick has never degenerated to the point he's talking about whether his end table set completes him is a good thing.
You haven't listened to him after four whiskeys, but anyway.
Dale and I have had some talks.
The other point is this movie really suffers from what I like to call Gatsby syndrome.
Oh, sure.
Where people take the completely wrong meaning away from it. Like, The Great Gatsby. F. Scott Fitzgerald hates Jay Gatsby. He wants you to hate Jay Gatsby. But everybody reads is like, oh, that's awesome. He's rich and he is throwing massive parties every week and he just wants to find love. No, he doesn't. He's an asshole who sold his soul and gained nothing from it and ended up alienating everybody around him and then was dead in a pool.
Yeah. I thought he was just supposed to be tragic. He did all that stuff for a woman who would never love him.
No, he's an asshole.
He's both.
I have never read nor seen The Great Gatsby.
Don't see the new one because they got it completely wrong.
Okay. What do you recommend?
There's one from the 70s with
Robert Redford. That was okay.
I like the new one, so he's wrong. But the book is short. You can handle it.
Well, okay. That's the whole thing. Is like everybody in college is like seduced by Tyler Durden, and they're like Nick, going, "Yeah, that's awesome. I want to tear down the establishment." The whole point was that that's a really dangerous thing to do. And watching it now, I realize, oh yeah, that really is the point. And Jared Leto, who is in this movie, is just a really stupid, vulnerable young man.
Yeah, Jared Leto is just getting punched to death. His angel face.
That was great.
The most cathartic scene in the movie. But also, I want to say, it's interesting though, the movie for calling Rob Paulsen Bitch Tits. Bitch Tits' full name is Rob Paulsen. Who's the guy who's Yakko Warner.
So, funny enough, that's actually a call line in the Rocky Horror Picture Show. So, Meatloaf is in Rocky Horror.
Right.
And he's Eddie. And at the end, Eddie is dead. Frankenfurter kills him. Spoiler, bitches. And so he pulls off the sheet and he's laying there dead. And everybody, again, this is 20 years older. Everybody in the audience stands up and starts chanting, his name was Robert Paulsen. It's the most amazing thing. And I think to myself, I can't believe this still holds up.
That's
Speaking
funny.
Speaking of Rocky Horror, when Richard O'Brien first shows up, does everybody just go, Mr. Murdoch, yes. Where is he?
They have no idea who he is.
Yeah.
I don't know.
No, I mean, the point I was going to make, though, is...
You'll have to save it for the Patreon.
You have to save it for the Patreon.
That's right.
The point I was going to make, though, which is kind of weird, is... We learn from our mistakes, but our mistakes are what define us, right? So everyone knows Tyler Durden's name. No one knows Jack's name at the end, even though he's, like, he's the real person, right?
I've not read the book, but I've heard how that ends with... It ends with Ed Norton in an insane asylum, right? And all the...
Well, it ends with what in... I took a satire class where we addressed this movie. But it ends with what they call a crowded scene satire.
Satire class? How many credit hours is that?
3. I was a film minor. I know. But everyone in the entire book shows up and says, stop! And, like, they try to save him. Like, and you know at that point he's insane because in real life, not everyone in your entire life comes up to try to save you at once. And it's because at that point he's had a complete mental break. And so they stop Tyler Durden by having everyone else in the world show up. And not unlike A Beautiful Mind, you realize that all of it might be fake. Mm.
Was Russell Crowe in A Beautiful Mind?
Yeah, he was in Nash himself.
He won an Academy Award that
Did you know that Russell Crowe was originally considered for the part of Tyler Durden?
I read that on the Tribune.
You know what? I'll take it because he's also a bruiser at that time. Now he's just a pudgy asshole.
Remember that? He was a neo-Nazi in that one movie, wasn't he? Romper Stomper?
Yeah, but that's even 20 years before this. That's when he was still in Australia.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, like him and Mel Gibson started as like the rough end of like film, like when film was like punching people to death. I don't think there were extras in Mad Max. I think they just killed people and replaced them.
So again, another interesting tie, and that is Russell Crowe is one of the few famous shadow casters of Rocky Horror Picture Show.
No
he
kidding.
He played Dr. Scott in a Seattle Rocky Horror.
No shit.
Yes, he did.
I just like to point out that I could totally see Russell Crowe doing Bob.
No kidding. Yeah, with the fake tits.
Yeah, with the exactly.
Really? No, I wouldn't.
That might be why it's funny, because Russell Crowe is like a tough guy, and seeing him reduced to that state would be amusing.
Well, to be fair, and this is something I never picked up, that was the whole point of Bob's character. He was like a champion weightlifter.
Yeah, he got testicular cancer from the steroids.
He was addicted to steroids, yeah.
I mean, my favorite part, like, because, again, the whole thing is the battle between Ed Norton's humanity and Tyler Durden, who has no humanity. He thinks he's helping people, like, but he doesn't want even anarchism. He wants tribalism. He wants to burn the world.
He wants to... This world is... in chaos, and I just have to rule it, or however that line goes.
He's, I think, an anarcho-primitivist. Like, he's talking about people grinding corn on the ruins of skyscrapers. That's actually an ideology.
It is. It is. Like I said, it's like a primalism. It's tribal. Whatever. My favorite part is that Bob gives up right away, right? Like, he doesn't take the insult, like, because it's like a bastardized version of Shintoism, where you reject, or traditional Orthodox Judaism, where, so what is it, like, 8 rabbis, you're supposed to be rejected 8 times when you're trying to convert. And, like, the idea of being sent away, like, you're scum, and he picks up his stuff and leaves. And it's the one time that we see Edward Norton really break and go, no, they're testing you. Like, he's trying to support a friend who's literally dying at this point, right?
Yeah.
You also realize, too, which is something I only watched this time and noticed, bitch tits this time, he's the only one who gets to keep his shirt on.
Well, yeah, because they had to hide the illusion of the fat suit that Meatloaf was wearing.
But it's the only person who's allowed to break the rules. They let him break the... Ed Norton, Jack, lets him break the rules, which, remember...
Which tells you that there's something deeper emotionally underneath.
You could have had CGI. There's bad CGI in this a lot. A lot. You could have faked that suit.
Penguins?
No... And when he puts the gun in his mouth and blows his jaw off, and he turns into a, like, what, a Stretch Armstrong doll for about 6 seconds, when I watched it, I said to myself, because I was alone, my wife said, I'm not going to rewatch this movie. But I practically said, you can't watch that on television, because goo was just splattering on people like a Nickelodeon sitcom.
No,
I'm turning it down.
I was on an episode of Double Dare once. That's just a random.
Oh, you know, it was like a you realize you're an ongoing series on Patreon. I just, I'm there with a cigar like it's out of a 1950s. Today on Every Day with Candace, we're going to talk about a traumatic event. So, Candace, have a whiskey.
Exactly. I'm like, thank you.
I would have imagined you more on Figure It Out myself.
I was a little too old for that show.
How about Legends of the Hidden Temple?
I'm a little too fat for that, probably. I'd have been like, Temple Guard, take me.
You could have totally doubled for the Shrine of the Silver Monk.
I love it. I love you both. All right. We're actually short on time.
We haven't even talked.
Listen, let's do a 5.5-hour episode about this hour-and-a-half movie.
You haven't listened to our Bond shit. It went on for 2.5.
Okay, well, something... This movie was pretty good. The main problem I had in it was actually just too long. Like, they've been tightening up a little bit.
It's just 2:20.
Which scenes would you have cut out? Because I couldn't think of any.
I don't know about cutting whole scenes, but maybe tighten up a little of every scene.
I will say,
don't lose anything. Like, I've cut thousands of words off my writing project by cutting like 3-4
I'm sorry,
words
what's
per
the name
page.
Of your book?
Yeah, please. You want to plug your book again?
I didn't do it earlier. I thought I'd give you a break.
Please.
Do it. I want it. I need it.
Right, where's that called?
The Thing in the Woods. but it's a tentacle monster the size of a tractor trailer truck. I'm sure it can satisfy everyone.
But I was going to say, some of the things I would cut, there's like 9 too many scenes with his boss.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I agree with that.
They keep cutting back to that boss. I mean, the scene I remember, which they cut back to, is the one where he's in that bullshit PowerPoint meeting and he just shows his bloody gums. They're like, ha, 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 what do you think there, buddy? And he goes, that's the scene you keep. The rest is just the same things 9 other times.
But listen, they have to keep that because that's the way to draw you in to make you feel as put out by Edward Norton, because it's much like the Office Space complex that I have 7 bosses and I get 7 different fucking memos about my PTS person. Mm-hmm. You have to feel as put out as he is, because otherwise you're going to be like, why are you complaining? You have a good job. It's, you know, it's an easy job. It's a desk job, blah, blah, blah. You have to be like, God, this is just fucking going on and on. There's like never any end. And you're supposed to feel as sad and as hopeless as he is.
But as long as we're critiquing directors who are some of the best of our generation, and I will, because this is a podcast that's literally listened to 5s of people. I would
listen,
have
listen, Australia loves you. I've seen the numbers.
I would have loved a scene, though.
Hey, mate.
Yeah. Where, you know who it says, like, he's wearing his cornflower blue tie. It must be a Wednesday. I would have loved it if there was just a scene, where, like, a really quick cut, where it shows every day of the week, where he goes Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and just, because it's not the first time there's typeface at the bottom, so it just goes, blink, Monday, blink, Tuesday, and, like, it just shows, like, the various shades of blue, red, and yellow that his ties are, because the first... I'm going to call it the act. It's not really the full act break, but like where it's the IKEA, it's him feeling drained and boring. That's a lot of quick cuts. And then in the beginning of the second act, it slows down. If you keep those quick cuts up when he goes to work, it tightens up the script, but it also makes work feel like chaos and everything else feel like he has control. And this movie is about what you have control over and what you have chaos. And chaos is like business and capitalism and work versus anarchy, and you get to just have golf balls that you're breaking windows with at the paper plant?
I disagree. The anarchy of chaos is what is attractive to him. Mm-hmm. It's the monotonous.
But monotony, you should speed up then, I think.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I think it's just a personal preference. I thought it also ran long, but I thought it was done on purpose, and it resonated deeply in my dark, empty soul.
Well, you can show how much this sucks, that the total amorality of his little formula, you know, is it going to cost more to recall the car or buy off of the people who get hurt in accidents?
Well, wasn't him. That was the company he was representing.
Well, and I loved it.
That's enough to show how much the situation sucks.
And that poor woman next to him, where you can, like, see the color drain from her face, and she's just like, does that happen a lot? And he goes... all the time.
Yeah.
And it's not even like a pickup line, but he says it almost as though it's a pickup line, as though he's converting her to his lifestyle. Like, the world you live in is a lie. Like, he has no color to his eye. Like, it's not that Ed Norton is particularly dynamic. The other movie I remember him from the most, he's in black and white the whole time. But he has vividness in the narrowness of his face, right? It's almost like Pee-wee Herman, where he can turn it on and turn it off. And that moment where he's like, people die because the rear transit, like the brakes tubes break in 1,000 miles or whatever he said. And he just kind of goes, it happens all the time. As though he's not looking at anyone. That's the most horrifying part. Project Mayhem is a cartoon of what you think when you're big. Like,
yeah.
I'm also going to have a treehouse with my friends and a video game console that plays all the games. His world is much more terrible.
Police at the coffee shop.
Because the whole point is that him and his real job is much more deadly than Project Mayhem. Yeah.
Speaking of the coffee shop, did you know that there is a Starbucks cup in almost every single scene of the film?
It is.
I tried looking for it because I'd heard that and I didn't see them.
You are filled with denial.
I know I am.
And soy latte.
Also, I like the idea that Milwaukee's best one for the beer or whatever that was. That was the cheapest beer I'd ever seen.
So in terms, and you as a film minor might appreciate this, you know Howard Hawks.
Minorly.
Yeah. Axiom on good movies, right? Three good scenes, no bad ones.
Yeah.
I think this passes that test because despite everybody saying it's long, I can't think of like a bad scene I'd cut out. And I think there are three good scenes in here. There's that scene with where he's...
I think the scene where they're on the airplane is a masterful scene.
That's a good scene. The scene where he's with Marla and it's like that long... It looked like a long shot, if I recall correctly, mm-hmm. for like stealing from the laundromat and then just selling at a thrift shop as they're splitting up support groups to go to was a great scene.
Yeah.
That's a good scene.
That was a good mm-hmm. scene. And frankly, I don't know.
The IKEA scene on the toilet, I think, is a masterful scene.
The IKEA scene on the toilet's good, too. So there you go. Three good scenes, no bad ones.
Well, and I mean, there's some scenes that only work because of Ed Norton. But, like, for the example, the scene where he first cries on Meatloaf, I think, is a great scene where, like, he goes to the doctor. I texted these two that I'm like, all the scenes in the 90s were in vivid color for David Fincher had stolen all the green filters. Because this movie looks like it's you're watching it through a bottle of scope.
Oh, my God.
Well, you remember what Alien 3 looked like, right? It just sort of built from there.
Which one was that?
That was the one with the...
Prison Planet with the guy who's the Lannister patriarch now. And
Charles Dance.
Yes.
Yeah.
And everybody died off screen except for Ripley.
Yeah, it was not a great one. I think the directing was good. It was not a good horror movie. But we're at... 90 minutes now. We're almost at 50 minutes. We should give our final judgments. I'll start with you, okay. And then I'll end.
So I will say that the movie in 11th grade was confusing. The movie at 24 made absolute sense. And the movie now at 35 years of age still actually rings kind of true to me. I have a chip on my shoulder. I feel very constantly upset about the state of healthcare. That's what I work in, the field I work in. And I almost want to rip down the establishment some days because I do patient advocacy and there's a lot of shit fucked up and it makes me sad in my heart. Not enough to blow up a building, but some days it's pretty fucking close.
If the FBI is listening.
Yeah.
Well, don't worry, only the FBI in Australia is listening. So
well, they're probably spying on me already, so I mean, you guys are probably in here as associates.
We need to know where he buried that thing in the woods. Sudsy Dan?
Well, first, I would just like to point out, it's ironic as we're recording this, I'm going to see the Pixies on Friday, so that's going to be a good show.
Fair enough, yes, sir.
I think that, again, when I was younger... Yeah, I mean, everybody at that age has those tear down the establishment fantasies, but that's not the point I think that the movie was trying to make. And I think watching it now, I finally understood that point, which is about how very evil people can exploit those vulnerabilities and take it to something that's horrifying. I mean, the entire last act of the movie is about Ed Norton trying to stop these people from carrying out their plans.
And when he tries to snitch on them, it turns out they've infiltrated the police department, then try and castrate him.
Yeah.
No.
We gotta take his balls!
Is that something that you've heard quite a bunch on the first date there, Matt? No. But anyway, yeah, I think it's...
No. It's marriage vows. Yeah.
I still think that it works at that level, and it actually works a lot better at that meaning than it did when you were younger, because you were just being seduced by... Tyler Durden and all of his talk about the all singing, all dancing crap of the world, which you were supposed to be, but you were supposed to pull yourself back from it. And the masterful thing about it is it works.
No. It's Matt.
Okay. Well, I saw it in college. Actually, I saw it at the University of Georgia, I believe the Myers Dormitory. I think I was a freshman. And it was still, I don't remember liking it or not liking it. I do remember liking it this time around, except it was a little too long.
Mm-hmm.
And I can actually agree with a lot of what Tyler Durden is saying. You know, materialism, consumerism, all that suck. But blowing things up and engaging in terrorism suck, too. That's not the proper solution to that.
He's evil.
It's okay, Daniel.
Well, yeah, evil.
Need
is,
a hug?
Yeah, and evil is a lot of times very seductive. That's what's. It's not going to show up being in your face bad. It's going to sound reasonable.
Evil's from a perspective.
Exactly.
Okay, well said. Okay, Darth.
What do you think? I mean, my final thought on this is.
You're a leader, Nick. What do you think, Nick?
I'm trying not to lead. Here's the thing I'll say about this movie. Tyler Durden is a well-designed character. You feel attracted to him because he's cool and you want to listen to him, but he's full of shit. He's the cool kid in high school, and that's why it works for when you're in high school and college. You acknowledge the fact that when you feel nothing towards ideology, someone who has ideology feels sexy. Right.
Does that mean that's why Brad Pitt was paid $17.5 million for this film and Ed Norton was paid $2.5?
Yeah.
He got $17.5 million?
Sure did.
Because if you switch the roles, it doesn't work.
Correct. I agree.
I mean, that's the thing. Like, when he shows back up with his head shaved because it's Project Mayhem, even though in the scene before when there's Project Mayhem, his head isn't shaved, you realize shit's going down, that shows that the movie functions, right? The movie works because these are fake emotions, people who are fake feel. And at the end of the day, when you break that emotion, when literally Ed Norton realizes, I have the gun because you're an imagination, and he puts the gun in his mouth, and he blows his own head off, effectively blows his jaw out. The movie comes together, not because the buildings are coming down, but because you realize we've all been sold a load of shit. Like, here's the thing, you're right, all of what he's saying is not true. People do feel complete because of their stuff, because if I didn't work, I couldn't do this hobby. If you didn't work, you couldn't do your hobbies. We put ourselves through crap because we put ourselves through crap so that we can enjoy our lives later on. If I didn't work, I couldn't spend time with my daughter, and vice versa. Same with my wife. So he's inherently wrong, but it's a good, sexy, attractive pitch, right? And you're right, I don't always feel masculine. I go to the gym to feel more masculine because I feel like I'm a blob without tits.
I feel more masculine than most dudes I know.
Because it's confidence. Nothing. I feel no more dominant than when I get comments from other people about this podcast or when I'm on my show at Cineprov.
It's ironic because a lot of times it's weird that when I feel very powerful, I feel masculine. Which tells me inherently that society's told me that you can only be powerful if you are a man, which is fine. I mean, that's okay. That's just it's the way it's been. That's fine. There's no crime in that. Things are changing. But it's weird that there's nothing I hate more than weak, indecisive men.
Yeah.
And just even dealing with them on a day-to-day basis in the hospital, it drives me fucking nuts because I'm like, if you should believe in anybody, it's yourself. And when people don't, I'm really turned off by even like interacting with those people. I don't feel like I can trust them. It's a weird scenario. I don't know why that is.
Well, and I mean, and that's the Tyler Durden thing, because the idea of Nameless Jack is that he doesn't sell himself. He hides other people's sales mistakes. To Tyler Durden, who's just like, buy other people. He's literally selling other people in soap form, and he's so self-confident. Right? You know, he doesn't have to sell anything about himself. I think this movie is interesting. I would not recommend it to anyone who is impressionable. Because the movie you're supposed to hate. Not that the movie's bad. I enjoy the movie. We all enjoy the movie. But all the opinions on it are inherently strong. I don't want someone who... The best parody of this is a movie called Weighted, starring...
Oh, Ryan Reynolds?
That's the one. Because it's about people who work in a restaurant. Mm-hmm. And literally, like, a woman sends back her steak because it's just not done enough. And that's where the waitstaff's, like, scratching themselves and, like, putting dandruff on the steak.
Is that the movie where Luis Guzman shows his dick to everybody?
It is. And then a woman shows fake pubes to people. Or the what's the big box movie starring that blonde guy who's married to Aubrey Plaza?
Employee of the Month.
Employee of the Month with Dane Cook in it. Mm-hmm. Like, it's those movies, because, like, I do sympathize with the hourly wage people. I managed to Walgreens, for Christ's sake. No one hates people like customer service people.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Lady friend?
No, I'm having...
Are you testifying?
I am. I'm having testify. A religious experience. Amen. Talking about customer service and how it relates to dealing with people every day, one-on-one, and making them happy, even though that might not be the best thing for them.
Well, right, because again, no one is pissed on more than waiters and waitresses. They're all, and people don't think that they handle their food, but they do. But, I mean, again, you can hate on Walmart all you want. There are people who work there every day. Don't hate on the employees, man. And that's what this movie is about at the end of the day. The problem is, it's a hyper-masculine movie.
It's pretty homoerotic at times.
I realize, too, almost none of the movies that we like, talk about, reference, or do on this podcast pass the Bechdel test, which is awkward enough.
Wait a minute, what's the Bechdel test?
Okay, so the Bechdel test is done by a cartoonist, actually, named Alison Bechdel, who talks about how there aren't enough movies where two women talk to each other and they don't talk about guys.
Wait, where there's two women...
They talk to each other,
right?
But they're talking about, say, the plot of the movie, like The League of Their Own, as opposed to talking about two guys. Like, even in Back to the Future, it's, oh, that McFly guy is so cute. That doesn't count because they're talking about a guy.
Now, what about, okay, in a situation like that, if they're, like, talking about the main character who happens to be a guy, the further the plot, is that still failing that test?
No, because it's generally if he's so cute. It's about how they want to date him.
Right.
But that being said, this movie has one female character the entire time, other than the cancer patient who has, I think, pancreatic cancer, who wants to have sex one last time before she dies.
That's
Chloe. Chloe, who's a great character.
Chloe is an amazing character.
Yeah, Chloe and the therapist is trying to hustle her off the stage, and she starts talking about
that's
sex.
That's hilarious.
That passes the Bechdel test, I think.
No, because she wants to have sex with a man.
Yeah. Well, she's not talking about a specific man. She's just talking about having having sex.
She was like, all I'm trying to do is get laid. She's like, I have many pornographic films
toys.
At my home and toys, lubricants. And I was like, this is the greatest thing I've ever seen. And at that moment, I was like, I'd f*** Chloe.
I thought the same thing, but my thought was, why doesn't Jack, let's call him, Ed Norton, not want to have sex with her? And the thing is, I think it's because she's being honest, and he wants to have sex with Marla because she's a liar, as like he is. They're both hiding something.
Yeah.
Anyway, so we are out of time. We're going to continue next week with Matt's Choice, which I won't give you a hint on. But no, whatever. I'll give you a hint.
Come on, Matt. Give us a hint.
Here's a hint. It sucked.
And it's on mental illness as well. And we've referenced it one this episode. But stay tuned next week and every future week. We'll put a bit of your past on trial. Go to the Facebook page and vote on which movie we should have done but refused to. Thanks, guys.
Is hosted by Nick Hoffman, edited by Candace Burns, and executive produced by Nick Hoffman and Candace Burns. It is produced by Daniel Suttis, Matthew Quinn, and Thomas Herman. We are a proud member of the ESO Network and a product of Blue Letter Podcasting. Our theme is Surf Shimmy by Kevin MacLeod. Find it at incomptech.com. It is licensed under Creative Commons, attribution 3.0. and thanks.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping through Amazon.com or the TeePublic store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.